Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh yeah, there's healthcare news today, but also this, what the government wants to do with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and a chat with the government's Pazar about compensation limits. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information is at massmutual.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 23rd of March, and it is good, as always, to have you with us. We'll get to healthcare and the new pay patterns on Wall Street in just a sec, but we thought we'd revisit the still fragile American housing market first thing today. We learned this morning that sales of existing homes stumbled once again last month. Prices were down, too, and that tends to drag on the overall economy, of course. But it also lends a certain focus to the grilling the Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner got today up on Capitol Hill. The topic at hand was the mortgage industry, specifically Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Back in the fall of 2008, you might remember, even before Lehman Brothers went broke, Fannie and Freddie were early winners in the government bailout game. Taxpayers basically own them now. Thing is, they're still not working very well, and Congress wants to know whether they ought to be overhauled or just done away with entirely. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
There are only so many ways to say, I don't know yet. That was Treasury Secretary Geithner's stock answer today at a congressional hearing on how to overhaul Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Now, I have not seen an ideal model yet.
Fannie and Freddie are a funny mix of public and private. They buy up mortgages, giving banks more money to lend. They now own or guarantee about half of all U.S. mortgages, some with a distinctive subprime stench. Some people say just abolish Fannie and Freddie. Karen Petru is a banking analyst at Federal Financial Analytics. She says that's just not practical. They're propping up the housing market. She prefers a middle road. Make Fannie and Freddie like utilities, privately owned, but with marching orders from Uncle Sam.
But they're much better regulated. So in terms of activities, pricing, and other functions, so that like electric utilities, you can be sure the lights stay on.
Banking consultant Bert Ely says the lights can stay on by themselves. The private market can take over. He says investors are already starting to jump back into the mortgage market, leaving Fannie and Freddie to a gentle demise.
It was a slow death. Not necessarily painful, but I think a slow fading away.
Economist Carl Case is co-author of the Case-Shiller Housing Index, which measures metropolitan housing markets. Case says Treasury Secretary Geithner is actually right. It's too soon to know what to do with Freddie and Fannie.
We don't know enough about how the housing market and financial markets are going to evolve over the next year to make a rational choice about what to do with Fannie and Freddie.
Don't expect a plan from Geithner until next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's been, about 24 hours or so since the news broke that Google is going to stop censoring its search results in China. Beijing, of course, has its own army of censors, so it's not like Chinese web surfers are getting any more information than they used to. Washington is trying to stay out of the whole thing. The State Department says it had nothing to do with Google's decision. But more worrying for Google, perhaps, was a move today by a well-known Hong Kong billionaire. He cut all ties between Google and his popular internet company in order to stay in Beijing's good graces. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now on some fears that other companies may follow suit.
At last check, Google controlled 36% of the internet search market in China, well behind its chief competitor there, Baidu. But in terms of ad revenue coming into Google from its business in China?
The true financial impact is quite minimal, at only 1% to 2% of revenues, and we think that's the more important aspect to look at.
That's Andy Meidler, a tech analyst at Edward Jones. He says he's disappointed that Google will miss out on potentially enormous growth in the Chinese market, but he doesn't expect this decision to have much of an impact on Google's business throughout Asia.
What we expect Google to do is to continue to compete aggressively in the Asian market, which offers higher growth potential, given that many of these markets still have a very infant internet advertising base.
But by aggravating China, Google may have opened up a can of competition. Whit Andrews is an analyst at Gartner. He says companies throughout Asia may back away from Google in order to take advantage of the situation.
Plenty of companies will sever ties to Google, perceiving accurately that there is now a vacuum in China for the services that Google provides, and that's to be exploited.
Others may spurn Google to keep Beijing happy. But Andrew says over the long term, Google will cement an anti-censorship reputation, which can't hurt for a global search engine. In the short term, of course, Google shareholders will be crying over today's stock slippage. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act became the law of the land today. From that, you might reasonably infer that it's going to bring health care costs down. Businesses have been crying for that for decades now, but even as President Obama put pen to paper today to make it law, some business groups were still complaining that health care reform doesn't deliver what they need. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
All through the health care debate, we've heard that out-of-control costs have been hamstringing big companies and even helped push some into bankruptcy. But you'll have to look hard for anything in the new law that directly addresses those costs. Professor Gerald Kaminsky of UCLA's Institute for Health Policy Research.
Health reform is really targeted at the small group and individual market and those who are uninsured. There are very few provisions of this that are directly targeted to large corporations.
Kaminsky says the hope is that by broadening access to insurance, the big corporations that pay for the bulk of the nation's health care now will no longer have to cover the cost of the uninsured. But he cautions there's no guarantee that's going to bring down premiums.
Prices are somewhat sticky. They rise quickly, but they don't necessarily fall in the other direction. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to see a drop in prices. I think what we're more likely to see is slower rate of growth.
The fear among small businesses is that reform will cost them. Businesses with more than 50 employees are mandated to provide coverage or pay a $2,000 per worker fee. Those with fewer employees are exempt, but at the National Federation of Independent Business, healthcare researcher Michelle Dimrob warns the added cost could still be stifling.
For those who are under 50, you're probably thinking that you're not going to be able to grow above 50 because then you're going to be hit with that employer mandate.
On the other hand, Steve Strauss, who wrote the Small Business Bible, says a provision for small businesses to buy from statewide insurance pools should boost their purchasing power and lower costs.
So it's intended to create more options for small business and more affordable options for small business, and that's what we want.
Even so, the National Federation of Independent Business says it's exploring its options to win changes in the new law. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Lest you think that now that the health care bill is signed, the debate is over, you should know this. It took all of 7 minutes after the signing ceremony for the first lawsuits to be filed. A group of 13 states says the federal government's got no business telling its people that they have to buy health insurance. In the court of the market economy today, that would be the stock markets, more good than bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Executives at AIG, General Motors, and Chrysler are in for a pay cut. Kenneth Feinberg, the Treasury Department's pay czar, released his 2010 report on executive compensation today. The top 25 people at companies that got what is referred to as extraordinary assistance from the government are going to be making 15% less on average this year than last. There will be restrictions on what can be cash and what has to be stock as well. But the real news is what happens after pay at the big Wall Street banks is cut. We've got Kenneth Feinberg on the line with us now. Mr. Feinberg, good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
There is obviously the headline number about reductions in pay at some of the big companies taking government assistance, but there was another little nugget in your report today that I wanted to ask you about. The fact that, contrary to what we had been led to understand by Wall Streeters themselves, when their pay was cut, not too many of these folks left their places of employment.
That is correct. That's the most important statistic, I think. Namely, that about 85% of the individuals who had their pay set are still at their desk working for these very five same companies. This is strong evidence that the pay determinations are not resulting in some sort of brain drain from these companies.
What do you make of it? Were they just fibbing with us or what?
No. I think probably that key executives at these five companies really did fear the likelihood that the competitive marketplace would attract key officials away from these companies. I was always very dubious, skeptical about this, and it's been demonstrated.
Do you think this data then will lead to some rethinking of compensation on Wall Street?
Oh, I don't know. I think historically there's always been a huge gap between Wall Street and Main Street. But it does make a difference in terms of my work because I'm required to take into account competitive pay as a way to keep people at their desks and not leave these five companies. And now the statistics seem to demonstrate that they're not going anywhere.
And so you could conceivably order further reductions?
I could.
Would you?
We'll take another independent look in 2011 for those companies that have not repaid the taxpayer.
I wanted to ask you about another item in today's announcement. That you're going to go back to the fall of 2008 before your statutory authority begins and look at J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs and other folks who took government money and investigate whether their compensation is contrary to the public interest. First of all, what does that mean? And second of all, what can you do about it if that's all you have to hold over their heads?
Well, you've raised a few questions. First of all, understand that my looking at these 419 companies is required by federal law. This is not something I made up. The Recovery Act, the TARP statute, requires me to go back to any company that ever received TARP assistance and examine their compensation practices to find out if those compensation practices are, quote, inconsistent with the public interest, unquote. Now, what that will mean, I'm not sure, but I suspect I'll look at how much compensation, was it guaranteed, how much was cash, how much was stock, if it was stock, over how long a period of time before the stock can be redeemed, principles like that.
You were, for want of a better word, the man when it came to financial reform last fall. Everything was all about executive compensation. And I wonder if you believe that that emphasis on compensation has slipped a little bit and if people maybe aren't talking about it so much anymore.
No. I still think there is a very high degree of public anger and outrage and frustration. And I think there is a lot of attention being paid by the public to what corporate America is making in the way of compensation.
Kenneth Feinberg, the Treasury Department Special Master for Compensation, otherwise known as the Pay Czar. Mr. Feinberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials climbed 102 points this Tuesday, nearly 1%, closed at 10,888. The Nasdaq put on 19 points, 0.8%, 2415 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, almost 0.75%, finished at 1174. Healthcare stocks started to shake out after that historic vote this week, and they landed all over the place. Drug maker Pfizer fattened up 2.25%. Merck added 0.5%. Insurers, another matter. Aetna gained 1%, but WellPoint carved off 1.2%. United Health clipped off 0.4% today. Intel computed nearly 2% higher. That was a day after Integrated Silicon Solutions, another chip maker, raised its second quarter outlook on sales and profits. That company rocketed up nearly 15% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of February. The Melanoma Research Foundation holds a briefing on controversies around indoor tanning and skin cancer. It falls a day before an FDA hearing on tanning beds. And it's the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The supertanker ran aground in Alaska's Prince William Sound on March 24, 1989. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The unemployment rate in this country has been within a few decimal points of 10% for a good long while now, 9.7% as of the latest reading. That was earlier this month. But the number does come with a fairly significant caveat. That 9.7% is across the entire economy. Some industries really haven't been hit all that hard by the Great Recession. And for others, like a big chunk of the blue-collar economy, it's more like a real depression. From WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio, Dan Bobkoff has more.
Labor economist Andrew Sum says white-collar workers haven't done too badly the past couple of years.
I've never seen any post-war recession such a one-sided, lopsided view of who's been affected.
Consider this. Yes, unemployment among white-collar professionals more than doubled since the recession began at the end of 2007, but at just over 4.5%, it's still about half the national average. For blue-collar workers, though, job losses have been devastating. Production workers have a 14% unemployment rate. Construction is over 20%. Sam, who heads the Center for Labor Market Studies at Boston's Northeastern University, says for these workers, it's more than just a recession.
The rate of decline among these men was equivalent to what we lost in the Great Depression of 1929-33.
Truck driver Tom Fisher knows that firsthand.
Good afternoon.
On the day I met him, he was pulling into a warehouse parking lot after an overnight trip to upstate New York.
Is it a good trip?
Yeah.
He works for a company on the west side of Cleveland that makes insulation for commercial buildings.
3 years ago, I was working 50 to 55 hours a week.
Here, at
just this one company. And anything over 40 was time and a half, which is good money, very good money for me.
Now he's lucky to work a couple days a week, working maybe 20 hours. As both residential and commercial real estate collapsed, so did construction jobs, and so did the jobs, like Fisher's, that support the industry. Fisher took a job at the Plain Dealer newspaper's distribution center late at night to make some extra cash, but even with the second job, he earned $12,000 less last year than the year before.
I live from paycheck to paycheck, and when you're $12,000 less, I'm not paying certain bills. Creditors are not happy. I'm having trouble at the banks.
But having some work makes Fisher one of the lucky ones. He knows a lot of independent truck drivers who went broke.
Well, I know two guys personally that just left their trucks right at the truck stop and walked away. Called their wives. The wives came and got them, and they just left them and let the banks go get them. Freight on it and everything. They just could not do it anymore. And that's sad.
On the other side of Cleveland, Tony Skettle is checking wiring at a recently sold house.
Yeah, look, see what the panel situation is. And
not many people are buying houses these days, so he's not getting a lot of work. His wife, Kathy, manages the money. They've owned Skettle Electric for 25 years, and until now, never really had to cut any staff.
A few years ago, we had 8, and we're down to 5, actually like 4.5, 4 full-time, 1 part-time. In the history of our company, we've only laid off one person before, and that was years ago.
Now, Skettle says she has to make cold calls and special offers to try to keep some business coming in. Unemployment in the construction industry has tripled. Meanwhile, the jobless rate in the financial sector is just 6%. Labor economist Andrew Sum notes the irony.
The architects of the disaster have not been strongly adversely affected.
Some is hoping lawmakers will create a stimulus specifically for construction and other hard-hit industries. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
There's something of an unusual meeting set for tonight up in Northern California. Local businesses, politicians, and farmers, I suppose you could call them, trying to figure out what to do if marijuana is legalized here in the Golden State. There are legislative moves afoot to make that happen. And for places like Humboldt County, which depends mightily on the underground pot economy, it is causing some angst. We've got Ellen Compa on the line. She's the Deputy Director for California Normal. That's the national organization for the reform of marijuana laws. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What are the folks up there worried about?
Well, there's a lot of change coming. We have two viable proposals for legalization in California on the table right now, AB 2254 in the state legislature and Tax Cannabis 2010 that's going to be on the November ballot. People want to know what that's going to mean to this whole community up here.
I guess the fear is that legalization in some form would lower prices for marijuana.
Well, yes, medical marijuana already has. I mean, you have up here, you know, backlanders who came back and have their subsistence farms and in the great tradition of American moonshine had a little bit of a cash crop, perhaps. And now medical marijuana has become an industry, not just a movement. And it's changed things already. Think tourism alone in California, the kind of business that we could have. We could be in Humboldt like Napa Valley is to wine.
Well, that's a really good point, actually, because I've been doing a little research, and Humboldt and Mendocino counties are like the Napa and Sonoma of the marijuana world.
They're known throughout the world as that. And now we're talking about how we could certify things organically in fair trade, outdoor grows versus indoor grows, educating the consumer about a product we had to be underground about all these years.
Is it reasonable to say that marijuana prices have, in effect, been subsidized by being illegal?
Yes.
And the day is coming when you're looking to lose that subsidy.
Right.
Do y'all worry about big companies coming in and saying, wow, this stuff is legal. Let's see what we can do about this?
Yes, people are very fearful of that. So it's really interesting because medical marijuana is serving as a model for what it would look like when it's fully legal. And it's all along. Medical marijuana collectives have to be nonprofit. They have to be small. So it may actually usher in a new era of a different kind of economy that isn't just based on big business, which is, of course, what the cannabis community has always been for.
There is a slice of the business community up there, though, that is not involved with marijuana in any way. How might they be affected?
Oh, I think they'll be greatly affected because this is a rural economy that depends on what's local. There's no lumber industry here anymore. There's no fishing industry. We've got water issues. And so it definitely has propped up things around here.
Ellen Kamp, she's the deputy director of California Normal. That's the national organization to reform marijuana laws. We were talking about a symposium up there in Humboldt County tonight, the Post-Marijuana Prohibition Economy Forum. Ellen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
As we gear up for this fall's congressional elections, voters over in the UK are expected to cast their ballots in a general election in about a month and a half or so. And like a lot of British politics, there will be some good stuff, stinging put-downs and elegant trashing of the opposition. One thing it's not going to have, though, is kind of financing that we're used to. British politicians face strict limits on what candidates and parties can spend. From London, Christopher Worth reports.
Okay, let's go.
So I need to
Local council member Tony Belton. Yeah, on a cold, rainy night, he's campaigning for re-election on a rundown housing project in Battersea, South London. Belton and his supporters are members of the left-leaning Labour Party, which has held this constituency for the past 13 years.
Hi. Sorry to bother you at this time of night. Can you spare just a moment?
This is a neighborhood in transition. The swank new American embassy will soon be located here, a sign of just how much Battersea has changed over the last few decades.
When I came here, the riverfront was all smokestack industries, and they've all gone. So all the people who used to work there have gone.
The old blue-collar Battersea was a Labour Party stronghold, but in 2005, Labour won here by a slim margin, just 163 votes. So the rival Conservatives are pouring money into the race here and others like it. They say they can raise about $40 million for the forthcoming general elections. Labour might only raise a third of that. In the U.S., candidates are expected to spend about $4 billion in the midterm elections. Justin Fisher is a professor in political science at Brunel University.
If you look at the sums that are spent in the UK, they're dwarfed by the sums that are spent in the US.
There are strict limits here on how much parties can spend on elections. It's no more than about $28 million each, though there's no limit on how much they can raise. In any event, costs are lower because paid political advertising on television and radio is banned. It's only in places like party websites that you find slick ads like this one.
I will vote Tory at the next election because I think they have the most to offer the UK. And I feel safer in their hands.
Britain's major political parties are given a small but equal amount of network airtime for free. Even so, they've still managed to rack up mountains of debt. Keith Ewing is with King's College London. He says Labour is still struggling to repay the roughly $21 million it borrowed during the last election from a handful of wealthy supporters.
We have this new phenomenon in British politics of the very rich sugar daddy who's prepared to fund the parties.
Recently, the Conservatives were embarrassed when it was revealed that one of their biggest sugar daddies, Lord Ashcroft, doesn't pay all of his taxes in the UK. But donors are a potential liability for both parties. Voters suspect that Conservatives, who get big donations from financial institutions, may not be willing to crack down hard enough on the banks. And Labour, which relies heavily on the unions for funding, may not be impartial in industrial disputes. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it was, as you might imagine, quite a scene in the East Room of the White House this morning as the president signed the health care bill. Much excitement and celebration. So much so, in fact, that Vice President Biden forgot himself a little bit in front of the cameras and the open microphones.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
I don't know if he could have heard it anyway, but we bleeped him out of an abundance of caution. But what he said there was, Mr. President, this is a big bleeping deal. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 101 points, nearly 1%. The NASDAQ rose 19 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 plumped up 8 points, 0.7%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod B. That's where you ought to turn tomorrow, by the way, for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, great deals for our northern neighbors.
Canadians are good at saving money. They just are. Or at least the Canadians who are coming down here to buy real estate have cash, and they have lots of it.
Oh, take off, you hoser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.